I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hello, this is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley. It's a podcast about making work better. How can we be happier in our jobs? And I should remind you, look, if you're interested in making work better, you can sign up for more and sign up for our occasional newsletter at eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. I'd be very willing to accept you into my professional network as well on LinkedIn. So, following the discussion with Andy Rhodes, the Chief Constable of Lancashire this week, this is a second episode about the police. And my original plan, I'll be honest with you, was to edit both of them and get one mega episode about the policing profession. But to be honest, both were just too good to chop up. So I want to flag that this is kind of about work culture, but also it's just a brilliant chat with a fascinating person. So if you're looking just for specifics about purpose and those sort of things, you're going to find it's filled, actually peppered with that, but also peppered with discussions about innovation in complex jobs. Consider it as sort of a box set with the other police episode. When it gets into its flow, it covers dog shows, walking buses, all manner of just like crazy genius. Today's guest then is Stephen Colgan. He joined the police after a bet from his dad, which he explains. And I was put onto him by our last guest, Andy Rhodes, who told me about the ways they'd used clever innovations to reduce the tension on council estates. And so rather than chop this chat down, I decided just to put it out. So Stephen covers the way that they led innovation in the workplace in the police. And I just find the whole discussion enthralling. It's just far too interesting for me to butcher it. Stephen is a perfect example of a multi-career life. He, after his career in the police, he retired after a full stint of duty in the police. And he found that via the illustrations he was doing, he found himself becoming friends with the comedy sci-fi writer Douglas Adams just before he passed away. And ended up through that becoming a writer on the TV show QI. He actually ended up writing a book about his police career and the career in the problem-solving unit in the police called One Step Ahead. And that's the book that I occasionally reference in my discussion with him. And he's in fact just published a novel called A Murder to Die For. Brilliant character. Utterly compelling in terms of his knowledge and his perspective and his thoughtfulness when it came to thinking about how to do the job. So I'm not going to lie, this was an evening in the summer. One summer evening, I travelled up to Amersham and we sat in the pub garden of a pub in Amersham. So I'm going to dive into my intro, but my intro actually starts... The tape was rolling and actually started with me reminding him about what this podcast was. And the chat it provokes is quite interesting. So here's Stephen. I do this thing on worker culture and like how to make work better. And I think the thing I found really appealing about your stuff here was that you seemed like at the outset, you know,
probably worth you explaining how you joined the police. But you seemed at the outset a bit of a troublemaker in the nicest possible way, in the way that people are sort of styled troublemakers, but are just asking difficult questions.
That's it. That's exactly it. I mean, a lot of people you would refer to as troublemakers, so people just see things from a different viewpoint and just seem not intent on upsetting the apple cart, but asking, you know, well, why have you got that sort of cart? Is there a better way of transporting apples? That's the way I look at it. I mean, you see a lot of this. I think that I might be a little bit on the ASD spectrum. I'm not entirely sure. My granddaughter's been diagnosed, and it's been very interesting watching how she relates to the world, because I can see a lot. She has a more severe form than I did, if indeed I've got it, because I've never been checked. But I can see so many aspects of the way she questions
things. In
what sense? Well, in the fact that she doesn't accept things as they are.
Right, she asking needs why three more times.
Absolutely, yeah, very much so. Why does that happen? Well, why? And she'll get to the base reason behind anything. And once she's got a satisfactory answer, then she can move on. And I was kind of the same, because you'd be saying, you know, well, why do we do it this way? Surely this isn't the most effective way to do it. Well, this is the way we've always done it. That's just not the answer I want to hear. If there's a better way of doing something, or why, another thing would be why a particular problem is occurring. Because people would just make assumptions. I'll give you a perfect example of this. Was there used to be this assumption, certainly among quite a lot of my colleagues, that burglaries went up during the summer holidays because the kids were off school. There was this assumption that, well, there's loads more kids, they're bored, they're burgling houses. I could never quite make that jump from, how does a kid go from being a school boy, because it's invariably boys, how do they go from being a schoolboy to being a burglar? And I could never figure that out. So I started digging and trying to find out more. And what I discovered, of course, was that was utter nonsense. There were more burglaries in the summer holidays because there were more empty houses because everyone's on holiday.
And you had the bins thing, right?
Yeah, the bins thing is a perfect example.
A good example, like if the bin's not moved back, then someone's out.
Absolutely. I mean, the bin lorries come round on a certain day. All the bins are pushed out onto the street. The bins are emptied. You know, the bins are generally scattered all over the place. And people who are home go out to try and find their bin and they haul it back onto their property. The bins that are left out are invariably by people who are commuters. They're at work. You know, they're out for the day. And they've all handily got a house number painted on them. So it's a great signal to a potential burglar. These are the empty houses. Let's go and case them. Let's see which is the easiest one to screw. You know, it's those little things. It's digging down that why thing about why does this happen and trying to find the underlying cause of problems. That really appealed to me, and that was something I loved. And
it's interesting, though. I've never heard it expressed in that way, because like the one thing that like is the holy grail that a lot of businesses seek for, and you see books on it now, which is this idea of psychological safety. And so, where psychological safety is the freedom to ask difficult questions, the freedom. But it's interesting that the way that you frame it, in that in a different time, actually people who maybe are less in tuned with what's acceptable ask those questions anyway.
I mean as I said, there may be an element of ASD, but I think the other big difference was the fact that I'd come from a completely different world of policing, because I grew up in Cornwall, as you know. My dad was a policeman in Cornwall, and the way it worked back then in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up is most people didn't own their own houses back then. So police officers lived in police accommodation. They lived in married quarters. So my neighbours were police officers as well. And so most of the kids I hung out with were the children of police officers. So I was very, very embroiled in police culture. And but what struck me was, in somewhere like even a largish town, I mean, we're sitting here doing this interview in Amersham, which is, you know, end of the Met Line, out in Buckinghamshire. It's a reasonably large town. Helston, the town I grew up in, is about the same size. And yet, I can guarantee you, there's more graffiti, more damage, more crime here than there ever was in Helston. And part of the reason for that is that in Cornwall and in rural communities, you people live there, they go to school there, they get married to someone they went to school with, they have kids there, and they die there. And you get extended families that don't move. I mean, give you an example. I mean, I lived 8 miles from Falmouth, or 10 miles from Falmouth. And if people were moving house, they wouldn't dream of going to Falmouth. They'd just find somewhere else in Helston. People tended to be quite parochial and stay where they were. So everything was connected to everything else. So there was a kind of bush telegraph operating in the town, to the extent that if something happened, if I'd been up to no good in the town and someone had seen it, by a sort of process of sort of osmosis through the community, I can guarantee it would get back to my parents and they'd know. And the fact that I was a copper's son as well, you know, put extra effort into that. When I came to London, the difference here was that a lot of communities are very fractured, because people have come from all over the country to come and work in London, and particularly around the commuter belt like this is, And even if you go in a little bit closer, you know, you're going towards Ealing, Acton, Greenwich, all these sorts of places that are around the hub of central London. People don't know their own neighbours because they've come from all over the country and indeed all over the world to come and work in London. And they get up in the morning and they get on the 6:30 train, they go into work, they work for 8-10 hours, they get on the train coming home, they come home in the dark, you know, in the winter, they go home, have their dinner, sit down and watch the telly, and that's their lives. They don't become part of the community, and they're not embroiled in the community and what's going on in community affairs. I mean, I was a part of that myself. I worked in London for 30 years commuting in from Buckinghamshire, and when I retired I suddenly realised I knew nothing about the town I live in. And all my friends were in London. I had no friends here either because my life had been commuting. And that's the big difference. You had these dysfunctional communities in London. And in London, they're very, in Cornwall, they're very functional. And so immediately I could see a difference between how policing works in somewhere like Helston in Cornwall, where policing is very much with a small P and everyone is playing a part in it.
Right.
So you didn't need that many cops, you know. There was maybe only about 10 cops at Helston Police Station compared to Amersham, where everything is disconnected. The community aren't really part of the policing process. And so they've got, you know, 50, 60 cops and they're still overloaded. It's that was the huge difference for me.
And so you came, so to go through what you did, I mean, you joined the police part of a drunken bet with
it was
man,
it was
right?
A drunken bet with my dad, yeah. it was whether or not I was man enough to survive for 6 months.
He played you, but amazingly
brilliant bit of problem solving. Yeah. He got rid of this tatty, scruffy, bearded hippie child and got me into a career for 30 years and out of his nice pretty little cottage at 50 quid bargain, and I thought I was winning. He was a very shrewd man.
And so tell me, how long into you being in the police, so you spent 10 years in like the problem solving unit, right?
Yeah, at the end of it. Yeah.
So were you doing these problem solving things before?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean there were several things that sort of hit me the minute my feet hit the ground at Hendon at training school at the police college. There were things that didn't ring true for me, and I mean I should say my mindset at this point was, I'm only here for 6 months to win a bet. I'm not really worried whether I rock the boat or not.
And your appraisals didn't sound like they were going
amazingly
well.
Oh, my appraisals were terrible. Absolutely terrible. How many times I got told, you know, this really isn't the job for you. You should think about leaving. But there were things that didn't click for me. The first thing that didn't click was that one of the very first lessons we had at Hendon, so this is one of the very first sitting in a classroom learning to be a police officer, was about the history of police. And so we learnt about, you know, Robert Peel and the formation of sort of organised policing systems. And the first mission statement for policing, the first written down set of instructions as to what policing is for, were written by a guy called Sir Richard Mayne, who was one of the Met Police's first commissioners. And it starts, the primary object of an efficient police is the prevention of crime. That's the first sentence. The second sentence is, you know, the secondary function of police is the detection and apprehension of offenders when you've been unable to satisfy the first job that you've got, which is prevention. And immediately I looked at it, I thought, well, yeah, of course that's right. Prevention must be the primary object of policing, because if you look at it logically, I mean, if you can prevent... I mean, I think if you were to go out into the street and do a street poll of people and say, would you rather the police are really good at catching bad guys and that penalties and punishments were increased and, you know, more people were going to prison, or would you rather not be burgled? I think most people would rather not be burgled, but... Well, it'd be a very strange person to say, no, I'd rather be burgled but catch the bad guys. Because, of course, you can't have bad guys until they've committed a crime. And yet...
So you were just the man who put his hand up and said, we're not doing the things...
So what prevention do we... You know, well, I'd sort of logged onto that. I thought, great, so the primary object is prevention. That makes sense, because when you prevent crimes from happening, you know, the prison population doesn't increase, the police haven't got so much to do, you know, insurance companies aren't overloaded, the NHS isn't overloaded. More importantly, you don't get victims, you know, both physically and emotionally victimised by someone being in your house or stealing your car or beating you up or whatever. And but we got sort of into the training. It was 4 months of training in those days, 16 weeks. And we got sort of 4 weeks in, and I realised, yes, we have to learn the basics, like, you know, law and police procedure. We have to learn our powers of arrest. We have to learn all about use of reasonable force. You've got to learn about courts procedure. But there was nothing about prevention. So, yeah, after a while, the hand did go up saying, what do we do about prevention? What do we do about stopping crimes from happening? At which point, I was told, well, that's not something you have to worry about. I thought, really? But I eventually finished Hendon, got pushed out to my first police station. And again, the question was, what prevention are we doing? Because it seemed to me that all the police officers just running around like blue-ass flies from one call to another, reporting crimes after they'd happened and trying to catch people who'd committed crimes. And I thought, well, if you were stopping the crimes from happening, we'd all be less busy and everyone would be happier. We wouldn't have all these victims. And they said, no, it's not your job. That's the job of the crime prevention officer. And I said, officer, what, singular? And it was. Every borough in London, 32 London boroughs, had just one single crime prevention officer who
what
was...
What did they do? Go around and give stickers out?
Yeah, he was invariably an older police officer who was coming out towards retirement, right. who was sent on several courses, you know, training courses by the Home Office, and went to seminars and things like this, you know, run by sort of locks companies like Chubb and people like this. And they would learn all these preventative techniques and things people can do to sort of stop their cars being stolen, their houses being stolen. And their job was to go out and tell the public this. But when you're looking at somewhere like, you know, the London Borough of Ealing, which covers Ealing, Acton and Southall, you know, it's a massive...
Yeah.
I don't know how many people live there. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be hundreds of thousands of people. One officer isn't going to be able to go out and knock on every door and give crime prevention advice. Whereas I can remember my dad telling me about when he'd first joined the police back in the late 50s, that crime prevention was part of what he did. You'd be walking along and you'd knock on a door and say, hello, Mr. Smith, I notice you leave your windows open when you go out. You really should shut those, you know, because someone could get in there. Or I notice you've got louver windows. They're really easy to pick out, you know. And they'd be offering that kind of advice all the time. And they'd also be building these bonds with the community so everyone knew who the local police officer was. So they knew I could phone up, you know, PC Colgan, you know, for advice. Or I could tell him something in confidence. I knew it would go no further. Whereas, by the time I joined the police in 1980, it was exactly the opposite. If I'd been seen sitting behind a cafe having a cup of tea with the owner and chatting about the problems he's got around there, that was skiving. You know, I should be out trying to catch bad guys. And we were judged on our figures. We were judged on how many arrests we'd had, how many stops and searches we had, how many convictions we'd got at court. And the reason was the workload was so big, and it was nothing compared to what these poor sods have got to deal with now, that was an easily countable object that you could hold up to your bosses and they could hold up to the Home Office and say, look how busy we're working, look how good we are, we've had this many arrests. The problem is, of course, that they're all inputs. They're all measurements of police activity, not what police are achieving. Yeah. They're not measuring the outputs. What we should have been checking is, do people feel safe in their homes? Is crime overall on a decline? You know, are we making an impact? And of course we weren't. But it's really hard to measure prevention.
Yeah.
It's really hard because you have to first of all prove that it was what activity you and the community were involved in that actually caused the reduction in that particular crime. And you've almost got to be able to prove as well that those crimes would have happened if you hadn't done what you'd done. Yeah. Prevention's really hard, and it was very much in the too hard bin. So I was told, you know, forget about the prevention thing, it's nothing to do with us. Just get as many arrests as you can. And I wasn't happy with that. And I knew I only had 6 months, you know, and I knew I was going to be...
You were definitely sticking to your old man's
thing. Well, I say that. I got to the end of 6 months.
Sounded like you were enjoying life in London.
I was enjoying myself so much. I was going to gigs. Because bands didn't come to court.
That's right.
I loved music. And bands didn't come to Cornwall in those days. We had to drive 70 miles through the whole length of Cornwall to Plymouth if we wanted to see a band. And then it was generally a C or D list band, you know. Or some old prog rockers from the 60s or something. I was enjoying the social life, I was enjoying London, and I was enjoying the buzz I got from actually, you know, when you did get a 24% reduction in crime in a particular housing estate and you knew it was what you'd done and getting the community to do things. That was brilliant. That was such a buzz, and people saying to you, thanks ever so much for what you've been doing, we feel safe here for the first time in years. That was brilliant, but of course none of that went towards any of my appraisals. All it looked like on paper is I was a lazy cop who hadn't stopped enough people or hadn't arrested enough people.
And here's the thing that I found interesting, that is that you were reading, I saw echoes of this, you see. You were reading papers on criminology and you were reading what people were discovering in the world of academia and then realising that frontline coppers weren't exposed to any of this, and they weren't. And I've noticed the same in, you know, the whole of my fascination is I was sort of in an office environment thinking, I wonder if there's a way to make this better. And then you start seeing that there's loads of research on this.
Yes, absolutely.
So were you alone in sort of doing those things, or did you find a few kindred spirits?
I felt that I was alone for a long time, and then I started discovering, what made the difference is I actually managed to get a posting to Hendon as a trainer. Now, it was... IT was just coming along, computers were just coming along, and this was the early 90s.
Yeah.
And I had a bit of a flair for them. So I got a job at what was then the Metropolitan Police Telecommunications School, which is a little annex part of the Hendon Training School estate. But we had a quite a lot of input into syllabus design for the main training courses, because, of course, all the new coppers coming out had to learn how to use computers for the first time and how to use word processors, because they'd been using typewriters for all their statements and things. So I got a much greater exposure to a much larger number of police officers. And what I discovered is, amongst some of the other trainers, whether they worked at Hendon or whether they were trainers out on the borough, you'd meet line-minded individuals who thought exactly the same way as I did. Quite a lot of them were what they called in those days home beats, which was effectively a community police officer, someone who had a dedicated area to look after. They were their local bobby. A lot of those were very much online. But then occasionally you'd meet some people. There was a guy called Neil Henson who thought exactly the same way as I did. And he'd also upset all of his bosses by deciding to do things that were more likely to stop crime from happening, or were more likely to catch the bad guys and put anyone else off doing it in future, by putting things in place to sort of basically a sustainable solution so the problem didn't come back. I got a phone call out of the blue, basically asking me to come up to Scotland Yard from a guy called Tim Godwin, who at that time was the Deputy Assistant Commissioner. And the idea was, he was putting together a team to explore some of these ideas, because he'd been out to America and he'd seen... It was just after all the big stuff that had gone in New York with Rudy Giuliani, and Bill Bratton. Even though Giuliani may have turned into a Trump-loving lunatic since, at the time he got a lot of praise because he appeared to have brought crime down in New York. Now, it's a bit controversial, some of his claims, because crime was already on a decline before Giuliani even got on the boat. And Giuliani is very good at claiming credit for things that he didn't necessarily do.
Yeah, I think Britt Brara says that he claimed credit for absolutely everything.
And he's a good politician, you know, in that respect. He's very good at claiming credit for what he wasn't doing. But, and the other thing is, of course, he did a lot of work in bringing in what the press called zero tolerance policing, this idea that everyone has to pay for their crime, no matter how small the crime is, that there's no let-off. You know, there's no... cops no longer have a discretion. If you commit a crime, you're going to get arrested. Simple as that. It's a fairly harsh regime. I'm not very keen on it because the people committing the small crime at the very, very bottom end of things are quite often the poorest in society and the people are most disadvantaged. And sometimes they're stealing food because they haven't got food, you know, and saying that they will be punished equally as well as someone who's doing, you know, stealing $2 million in sort of white-collar crime. No, it didn't work for me. But under Giuliani, there was Bill Bratton, who was the chief of police. And Bratton is quite brilliant. Bratton had really cottoned on to this idea, something they call POP, problem-oriented policing. This idea that you orient all of your police activity around solving problems and getting to the root causes of things and tackling those instead of constantly responding to the symptoms of the problem. And Bratton did some extraordinary stuff in New York and said crime rates came thundering down. Tim Godwin and some other senior officers have been over to America, seen this working in places like New York, in places like San Diego, in places like, you know, unsurprising places like North Carolina. And he said, we've got to have something like this in the UK. Came back, started chatting people. Well, there's people already doing this and we've been telling them off. And it was, I think it was Tim Godwin used the phrase, you know, we're going to try and change you from pariahs to pioneers. I like the idea of sort of shifting the focus. And he put together this team called the Problem Solving Unit, which was me and four other people and an analyst. And the idea was, we would go and look at problems that had a history that didn't respond to normal policing methods, to see if we can come up with a sustainable solution for the problem, and secondly, you know, design something to stop the problem coming back, which could maybe be applied elsewhere as a preventative tool.
Right, got you.
That was
so,
the idea.
So when you went, so like, let's go into some of the examples are so colourful and lovely that, so the underpass problem, the underpass that was, does that give you enough to...
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
This is a perception issue, that one was.
Right, so was that a problem that you were called in to deal with?
Yeah, well, that one wasn't one that we were particularly asked to go and deal with. It was one that I became aware of through friends of mine, because it was at a station I'd previously worked at, and some of my old colleagues were there. And I just got phoned up saying, have you got an idea for this? And the problem was that there were a group of youths that used an underpass under a busy dual carriageway. They made it their hangout place. They used to ride skateboards up and down there. There was graffiti on the walls. They used to smoke in there. They used to drink in there. It was their place to hang out because they had nowhere else.
Nowhere to go.
And it was the only connection, apart from walking some way down the road and using a light-controlled pedestrian crossing, it was the easiest connection to get from quite a large housing estate, including a lot of retirement home-type places, to the shops, to the local parade of shops. And for a lot of people who were wheelchair users, it was the only way because it had sloping ends at both ends of the underpass, whereas otherwise they have to go all the way down the street, cross over the road and negotiate curbs and things like this. And they were scared of going through the tunnel because of the kids. And the kids were quite aggressive and quite rude when you approached them. And I looked at this and I thought, well, first of all, let's see how bad the problem is. Because the thing is, the perception by the kids of the old people was very negative. The perception of the older people of the kids was very negative. And all of it seemed to be based on hearsay. There didn't seem to be... I couldn't find anyone who could give me an absolute stone-bonker example of where they had been, you know, threatened by a youth or whether an old person had a go at them or anything like this. It was all hearsay. So what we organised as a sort of experiment was a walking bus, which is the idea that said, well, we'll provide you with police protection. That was the phrase we used. And myself and a couple of other uniformed officers, we walked through the tunnel with a group of the older people. But instead of just walking past the youth, we stopped and we talked to them. And you could see people sitting there going, what are they doing? What are these police officers doing? And the kids were quite negative to start with, and the old people were very negative.
Same time every day?
Yeah, we did this for 2 or 3 days. Yeah. And eventually there was a little breakthrough, and one of them... Because after about 2 or 3 days, both sides were starting to realise that the two groups weren't actually a threat to each other.
Yeah.
And then the breakthrough was when one of the older people said, are you such and such's grandson? And they was, yeah, what's it to you? And they said, oh, no, I live next door to your gran, you know, and I remember you when you were this high. And all their friends start ribbing their mate, oh, they remember you. And you had bright red hair, did you? And suddenly there's a little bit of humour, there's a little bit. And what we did over the course of a week is gradually reduce it down from having several cops walking with this group of people to then ultimately having just one community support officer walking with them to then no one walking with them, because now that the fear had dissipated and both groups had seen that neither side was a threat, they just, you know, there'll always be this clash between generations. Every generation sees the next generation as some kind of alien species. It's been going on forever. I can show you quotes going back to Plato about, oh, kids today, they're awful. It's always been the case. Yeah. But if you can break down that, communication is key here. If you can break down that wall of ignorance in the true sense of the word, the fact they don't understand each other's groups, so they don't fear each other anymore, then everyone can use the overpass in peace.
And this sort of was identical thinking for the dog show, right?
Yeah. Well, the dog show was a very similar thing. The dog show was a difficult one. It was, we had a very fractured community. We had a
where
lot
was
of...
it?
Where?
Yeah.
Where? In Greenwich, down near Greenwich. And it was a very fractured community. It's a big housing estate. There were a lot of... See, single mums get a bad deal. I think single mums are bloody brilliant with what they have to deal with. I think what should be getting the raw deal is the absent dads. No one ever uses the phrase absent dad. They always use single mum. But the single mums were doing the best they could, but there were a lot of absent dads, and the kids were running riot, frankly. And because they didn't have, you know, a proper functioning family to belong to, they made their own. And the gang problem was starting to emerge. And it wasn't as serious there as it was in some parts of London, in South London particularly, but it was emerging. And when one young lad got stabbed and killed, it became a bit more serious. And it became serious particularly because the video footage that emerged at the funeral, which I think was posted on YouTube and then got taken down quite quickly, was the gang carrying the coffin with masks on their faces rather than a family. Right. And it became a bit of a political hot potato, and Blair, who was in at the time, sent something through the Home Office that came down and said, you've got to do something about this estate. We can't have these sorts of video images up because it makes it look like we've lost control. And what does it say about the state of Britain today when a youth is tragically killed and it's his gang members who are carrying his coffin and not family or friends or relatives? So we went and looked at this estate. It was very dysfunctional. No one talked to anyone else. A lot of the adults, particularly the older people, were scared to come out on the streets. And the kids kind of ran the streets, and they would throw things at you from overhead and from passing vehicles, and it was awful. And one of the things I learned over the course of many years is that if you want to try and bring a community together, one of the first things you've got to do is try and find... One easy way of bringing it together is find points of commonality. If you can find something they can all focus on that they all want. And we thought, you know, this is a very diverse community here as well. There were many, many different languages spoken on the estate, and there were people from various different religious or sort of racial groups on the estate. We thought, well, What about something like a world food fair? What about if we have a street party with lots of different world food? And virtually no one attended. And then we tried something with a youth centre, which didn't work.
Police badged or community badged?
This is both. It's kind of done with the local community police officers. And we got the schools involved as well. And the local authority, obviously, everyone involved as much as we could. But it wasn't working. And then we thought, there's got to be some way to bring people together. There's got to be something they've all got in common. And I think it was the aforementioned Neil Henson. We were walking around this estate, and Neil, we were arguing over this, and I think it was me who said, do you realise that? I said, the one thing, there is a point of commonality, although I don't know what we can do with it. Everyone's got a dog. Everyone you see walking around has got a dog, either for companionship, for protection, or just because they like dogs. And Neil sort of looked across and went, dog show? And the idea kind of put down roots. We thought, well, you know, dogs are a great bridge. You know, they allow you to speak to people you wouldn't normally be able to speak to. I mean, another great example is the Fire Brigade. We'd done some work in Scotland, working with the Scottish police. This is a year or so later after this, when I was doing work with the Home Office. And we found the fire service was a brilliant bridge between cops and police and youth. The youth didn't want to speak to us because we were cops, but they'd speak to fire officers because they're kind of heroic figures. And they can't arrest you, and they can't confiscate your booze and all that sort of thing. So it was a great bridge between two groups. And we thought, dogs are the same, because if I see you across the road, complete stranger, and I walk over and say, hello, I'm Steve, you think, oh my God, I've got the loony. If you've got a dog, and I say, oh, that's a lovely looking dog, that's a lovely looking German Shepherd you got there, or Afghan, what's his name, how old is he? It's an instant bridge. And you feel warmer towards me, even though I'm a stranger, because I like your dog, and I'm saying nice things about your dog. And we thought, I wonder if we can do this through a dog show. So we... with the local police, and to their credit, you know, we might have had the idea, and we always did things and badged it very much with the local police, because if it was something done from Scotland Yard, if the press got over it, particularly the sort of right-wing tabloids, we did some things in the past, it was, oh, police do this instead of catching bad guys, front page Daily Mail, you know. So we would always try and badge it by the community and the local police if we could. We got some police dogs in to do a display. We got the Batsy Dogs, which wasn't very far away, involved. We got the People's Dispensary of Sick Animals, PDSA, involved. We got local vets, local schools, all these sort of things, organised all these competitions. We could. It wasn't easy to do a sort of best of breed and things like that, because everything seemed to be crossbreed, staffies and things like this. But we did it. Waggliest tail, or if they'd been cropped, waggliest stump, which I thought was a funny, funny category. Pointiest ears. We did all sorts of weird stuff. But it worked, and we realised that we'd started to make a chink in the armour when you see a little old lady about, you know, like a Monty Python, what they used to call the Pepper Pots, these little old ladies with the hats on, you know, go walking with their little dogs. And she was having a go at this 6'4" black lad who had something like a Rottweiler or a Staffy Cross. And she's having a go at him, telling him his dog's too fat. And he's going, she's going, what do you feed him on? He says, I feed him on this. Oh, that's rubbish. That's terrible stuff. You should be feeding him this. And he's trying to write down the brand name. And I thought, these two people would have crossed the road to avoid each other in any other set, because she would have been a little bit scared of him, and he would have thought, interfering old busybody. And it was joyous. And don't get me wrong, I can't pretend that the estate overnight became, you know, the most wonderful place to live in the world. But a few years later, when I went back to visit, and the work carried on, again, involvement with the schools, local authorities, local charities and third sector people, it had become a much nicer place. Mm. There was a communal garden where people were growing stuff in raised beds. People were out walking around the street and they weren't scared anymore. The gang problem had minimised to almost nothing. Crime rates had dropped quite substantially. And it had its problems. It still had a lot of problems. But compared to what it was like, it was paradise compared to what it had been like.
Yeah.
And it all started with a dog show.
Linking people and getting people talking together.
It's what it all comes back to. It's breaking down. I mean, I spoke at the Brighton Fringe a couple of years ago. I think 3 years ago now. And they had a brilliant scheme running down there that I think it's by the year 2020. They want to be the first city in the UK where everyone knows their neighbour. That's the simple plan. And all they're asking people to do...
And it's actually a tiny little step, right?
It's a tiny step. All you have to do is get to know your neighbour on your left-hand side, get to know your neighbour on your right-hand side, if possible opposite as well, but those two people, because if they do the same and the people next to them do the same, you create this gigantic Venn diagram where everyone is connected to everyone else, and it deals with so many things. It means you feel safer in your home because people care about you now, and they look out for your property when you go on holiday. They'll even look after your cat or your plants when you go on holiday. You know, sharing of power tools and things like that becomes much easier. Don't all have to own a belt sander if one person's got one on the street. Crime goes down because you're looking out for each other, and everyone feels happier. People feel substantially happier when they know their neighbours.
Yeah.
And it wasn't much to ask. It just get to know your neighbour on either side.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Back to Stephen. After I bought him a second drink in the pub garden, we started talking about an episode where people were complaining about noise from a local nightclub. He was called in to try and solve it in a quite brilliant way.
Cops don't have any power to deal with noise. You know, there's no power of arrest or anything to do with noisiness. And we don't have any instruments to measure the noise to see whether anything's... It's got to be dealt with by environmental health. All we can do is turn up and say, can you turn the noise down? And if someone says no, there's nothing we can do about it. It's a pain in the backside, frankly, but people will always phone police first. So there was that aspect of it. The police, it was a pain for us. And it was also a pain for the local authorities. They get lots of letters of complaint and people saying you should oppose their license, take their drinks license away, shut it down, blah, 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 blah. But, of course, it brought a lot of money into the community. It gave young people somewhere constructive, safe, to go to on a Friday and Saturday night. So you don't want to lose that either. Yeah. And we thought, well, let's go and see exactly what this problem is. So, because all we ever heard was, it would come out on the radio as, you know, disturbance outside local nightclub. And disturbance is a very nebulous term, which can mean anything. It can mean anything from people being a bit noisy to a riot, you know. Yeah. So we went and looked at the club, and what we realised was, it was a noise issue, and specifically... Sorry, ladies, but it was specifically women's voices, because women's voices are a higher register and right. They carry further, and women tend to gather more in groups than men do. So you've got a concentration of noise in one spot. Plus, they've just come out of a nightclub where they've had loud music playing. They're a little bit deafened. They're all a little bit squiffy as well, because they've had a few beers. You know, and they're toppling and falling off their shoes and giggling. And all very good-natured, but loud, very noisy. And we thought, there's got to be a way of, if we can just keep them quiet until the groups have dispersed a bit, so the noise levels are reduced by the fact that the larger group where the concentration of noises is dispersed a bit, how can we keep them quiet as they move away from the club?
So it's sort of only like a 1 minute job, really, a 2 minute job, get them away.
Yeah, just get them away and disperse the groups, so the noise levels get broken into much lower noise groups, as it were, much smaller noise issue. And our initial idea was, well, you know, we were cracking jokes, you know, sitting around the table thinking about it, saying, well, we can't gag people, and we can't sort of stick a dummy in their mouth or something like this, you know. But that's kind of what we want to do. We want to do something, you know, something that keep them quiet. And one of the guys came up with the idea, well, why don't we, they're going to be a bit dehydrated anyway coming out of the club, why don't we issue them more bottles of water? Or get the, you know, not out of the public purse, the club's going to have to pay for it, which will be built into the ticket price anyway, so there's no public money involved in this. And it seemed to work. People came out, they were having a drink of water, and you can't be loud and noisy when you're drinking water. But there were other issues with water. There was the disposal of all the plastic bottles. Right. During the winter months, we got sheets of ice forming on the road and things like that. So it wasn't going to be a good, sustainable solution. Someone suggested then using toffees or something, you know, or chewing gum or something like that. And toffees was okay until, you know, someone loses a filling. But then the idea of lollipops came along. I thought, lollipops are great. And they worked so well. I mean, if you've got a lollipop stuffed in your cheek, it's really, I mean, you stick your finger in there, it's really hard to be loud when you've got a, because you,
yeah.
It's really hard when you've got a lollipop in your mouth. And there was a secondary benefit we hadn't anticipated, which was brilliant. And that was that when you gave lollipops to blokes, they became less aggressive. I don't know whether it's a regression to childhood or whether it works a bit like a pacifier, but whatever. It's very hard for a bloke to square up to another bloke and say, do you stand on my shoes or you looking at my girl funny?
When
you've got a chupa chup stuck in your cheek, you know, or a lollipop. And it just worked so damn well. And we thought, this is a great good news story. And the Met Police press department said, this is a great news story. We've got to put this out because everything's always very negative.
Did they put it out?
So they put it out. And what we got virtually the next day from certain tabloids is police giving yobbos lollipops when, you know, they should be catching bad guys. This is how they're spending your public money. And then you get the Taxpayers Alliance, whoever they are, coming in and attacking you and this sort of thing. And it all became very negative. So we decided from then on we would never put a we would run everything under the radar kind of all these projects. But then what we'd do is we'd run these projects under the radar. Once they're up and running, if they were successful, because they weren't all successful, but 99% were. But if they were successful, we'd then take a step back, make it entirely run by the local community and with the police involvement.
Right.
And then that would get picked up as a good news story by the local press, and then the news trawlers would pick that up, right. And it would become a good, exactly the same story, and then become a good news story in the national news, if indeed it got that far. Because good news isn't good news, is it, for newspapers? They just want the bad stuff. It's a tricky
and
one.
In truth, it's impossible to be creative when you're under stress or when if you're fearing all the time what can go wrong.
Absolutely.
You'll never take any chance and you'll never do anything creative.
And we were very lucky that everyone in the problem solving unit was kind of a bit like me. It was, well, we'll give it a run. If it doesn't work, what the hell, we got big shoulders, we can take it. Most things worked. There were occasional things that didn't, but like I said, most things worked. And a lot of the solutions we came up with were actually quite boring. They're not as sexy as dog shows to stop young men knifing each other or lollipops to quiet and clubbers. A lot of it was just understanding the underlying causes of the problem and then knocking the bits out. Neil came up with a name for it. We called it the Nimitz process, because Admiral Nimitz during the Second World War had a much smaller fleet of ships with which to tackle the Imperial Japanese Navy. But what he realised is the Japanese Navy could only function because they had fuel stored on this island and water stored on this island.
Right.
So what he did was he mined all around the islands. So even though they had a much smaller fleet, he knocked out all the various supply chains, all the things that allowed the Japanese Navy to work, he knocked those out. Then the Navy couldn't function and he won. And we called it the Nimitz Principle. Neil came up with this, but we used it all the time. And it's, if you were trying to take out something like a drugs market, for example, you'd look at, well, what does a drugs market need to function? Right, it needs drugs, first of all. It needs money. It needs transport. It needs stash sites.
This is your puzzle sort of idea, isn't it?
It's the puzzle idea.
It's like, there's not one side. It's not about going to take out drug dealers. It's like you need to deal with the demand, the supply.
Absolutely. And you look at all those pillars that support this problem existing. You need to knock the pillars out one at a time, and sooner or later, it cannot function. And if you can do something with those pillars to stop them being able to come back, you've got a sustainable solution. It's not going to come back. And that was the thing that we loved. And a lot of those bits of work we did are actually quite dull to talk about, because it was just, you know, lots of research, lots of analysis, identifying certain people, identifying certain locations, that sort of thing, and then doing things at those locations to make things better. I mean, it's like they did a really interesting thing, the Wellcome Trust, did an interesting thing in America recently, where they took up one clinic and they brought in really quite severe rules about hand washing. They replaced the door handles with copper door handles, because copper is antibacterial. They had a regime where people were checked, their hands were regularly checked for bacteria, and they had to wash and scrub regularly. And they were aiming for something like a 50% reduction of superbug transfer. And they got 100% reduction.
Get out of here.
Just from enforcing existing systems. And a lot of the time, our problem solve was just doing that. It was actually just enforcing systems that were already there but weren't being used properly. But occasionally, like I said, you'd get the more adventurous things like using Big Brother eyes. This idea of having a photograph of a set of eyes watching you—it's a very strong effect. It's a very strong effect. If you've got a pair of eyes watching you, and you know wherever you go, they follow you around the room, even if it's a photograph on a wall, it naturally inhibits your desire to do wrong things.
It's like there's atavistic programming in
it. It's absolutely.
If we think that someone's watching us, we just behave.
We do. They're doing a really interesting thing at the moment, because That's the other thing. I would find people outside of the police service who were looking at this sort of thing, but for their own purposes. Like, right. The military had some really interesting stuff going on in terms of psychology for use in warfare. The NHS were doing some really interesting things. The people I found the most useful of all was advertising and marketing, right. People, because for years they've learned a whole range of skills to influence us to buy things we don't actually really need.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if those same influencing skills to be used to make people behave in a slightly different way so they're less likely to be the victims of crime. I mean, a great example of Ogilvy are the leaders on this, and Ogilvy won with Rory Sutherland sort of manning it. Good old mate of mine, Rory.
His name's in your book twice.
Oh, yeah, Rory's a good mate.
He sponsored and you twice.
He did, and he's a good mate, and he's... I think his TED talk, all about life lessons from an ad man, is, I think, the second most watched TED talk of all time. Extraordinary character. But he's done that. He's taken everything he's learned from advertising, and he's now applying it to make the world a better place through Ogilvy One, this branch of Ogilvy. Almost like running like a charity, really. And he did a great bit of work in Bristol a couple of years ago with a thing called the Put Pockets campaign, where he got an ex-pickpocket and two magicians. And
okay,
what they did was...
I saw this. Yeah, is this in your book?
I think it's in the book, yeah.
Right, okay.
Where they had basically little cards that looked like smartphones and small tablets. And what they did was they were going around putting them into people's pockets. And when people got home and opened their bag or their pocket, they found this thing saying, I got this into your pocket really easy. I could have got your real phone out just as easily. And it was extraordinarily good. I love things like that. I learn a lot from admin and ad agencies. And
it's interesting though, isn't it? Because like you talk in your book about like the Nudge Unit came along a few years ago, and sort of behavioural economics sort of came, like you say, through advertising, really,
yeah.
Because it was trying to bring the realities of human behaviour.
Well, I'd kind of discovered behavioural economics before I knew what it was called and before anyone had given it a name, really. It was just really understanding how people behave and how things behave. You can then plan for it. You can then manipulate it. You can make it work in your advantage. You know, and like I said, these eyes on the wall thing it just came from an observation that humans, as you said, it's a very atavistic thing. We are programmed to see faces and eyes and read. And if you see a pair of eyes that seem to be scrutinising you, you feel as if you're being scrutinised, even if it's just a photo.
Well, we see it in the patterns amazing. Of animal prints, right?
Oh, God,
like,
yeah,
if animal prints look like eyes, then...
That's like eyes or eyes on right. sort of butterflies' wings to stop
that's
owls
right.
eating them and things. Yeah, it's a very powerful effect. And I know Professor Richard Wiseman has done some really interesting things to do with babies, because babies have a very powerful effect on us as well. He did an experiment where he took a load of wallets that were filled with dead credit cards and the usual detritus you find in a wallet, you know, sort of driving license. Nothing was valid or current. And he just left them around in places. But in a certain percentage of the wallets, I think it was 10% of the wallets, he put a photograph of a baby.
Get out of here.
And the ones that had the photographs of the baby invariably got handed into the police.
Right.
And the others didn't, because you'd made a human connection with the victim there. And so they're trying an experiment at the moment. Ogilvy's involved in this I think it's in Ealing. Somewhere in West London, they're doing an experiment at the moment with babies' faces. Not just eyes, but babies' faces with eyes watching you as an anti-burglary tool.
I mean, it shouldn't work.
But it should, because humans are very easy to influence.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a guy called Dan Pink in America who does some great experiments. And I love... He had a program called... Crowd Control.
Yeah.
It was a series called Crowd Control. And one of my favourite bits in that series was where... He painted two footmarks in front of a cash machine, a hole in the wall. And, of course, people would go up, use the cash machine, and unconsciously they'd stand on the footprints. And then the next day he'd move the footprints like 6 inches further apart. And then he'd keep doing that. And there was a wonderful, wonderful video of this bloke standing there doing the cash machine with his legs spread as far apart as he possibly could, standing on these... Because we're just naturally...
Okay.
We're natural pattern finders. We look for patterns. And when we see footprints... unconsciously we'll stand them. If you put green footprints leading up to a litter bin, you'll increase the number of people who use that litter bin by about 40 to 50%. If you put footprints on the right hand side of an escalator, people will stand there without having a sign saying stand on the right. It's an extraordinary thing, and the eyes thing, and it's a science we're just really starting to understand, and we're discovering new things every day. There's a big conference every year called Nudgestock, which is all about behavioural economics, and I've spoken at the last two. And you get people there just talking from a whole range of different areas of work. You know, we get biologists, we get behavioural scientists, we get advertising people, we get IT designers, we get people from all different ranges of life coming in and talking about how they've discovered these delicious little nudges that just... It's not forcing someone to do something they don't want to do. it's putting a subtle influence in their way, which they can choose to ignore if they want to, but chances are they will probably follow it because their natural propensity is to follow the nudge. Because it does them no harm, it doesn't disadvantage them in any way, and B, they're just biologically programmed to do so.
Tell me this, though, because all of this is like incredible creativity, but if resources are more strapped than ever before in the police, surely there's a point where the pressure that people are under in their work means they're just scared to take chances.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And the danger is you've got two things, right? You've got this audience of people who are criticising anything that goes wrong, the press or whoever they are, and then you've got this fear that you haven't got enough resource. Doesn't that pressure just lead to the destruction of these brilliant experiments?
And we're seeing it in all walks of life at the moment. We're seeing it in publishing, we're seeing it in TV, in broadcasting. Publishing is very risk averse at the moment, you know, because there's only a limited pool of money. You know, publishers are, and people aren't reading as much as they did, and ebooks are easily copyable, you know, in the same way. Publishing is going through the same sort of problem that music went through a few years ago. When music went digital, everything was copyable, everything was piratable. And you know, albums disappeared, CDs have all but disappeared now, and the only way bands could now make money is by live shows and by sponsorship. You know, they don't make much money from the music anymore, and books are going through this same kind of revolution. TV's going through it as well. I mean, TV's become quite risk averse. You can take a really quite adventurous idea to TV production companies now, And they'll sit there and say, well, what else is it like? Is there something else like this that's already popular? Because if so, I might be willing to look at it. But if it's something completely off the wall, I won't take it. I mean, my boss at QI, John Lloyd, he's taken a number of things to the BBC in the last few years. Now, John's track record, we were talking about this earlier, is incredible. You know, Blackadder, Spitting Image, Not 9 O'Clock News, Have I Got News For You? He invented all these things. He's really good at knowing what the public are going to enjoy. But they're turning stuff down that even someone like he's taking him because there's nothing like it out there. It's like he said, if someone went in with Monty Python now, it would never have got commissioned. And if Blackadder had been made now, it would have been cancelled after series one, because series one didn't go as well as they'd expected. There's this, you know, money. I mean, the phrase I always use is the accountants have taken over the asylum. Money seems to be the only measure of value now. And that's a real issue, and it's an issue for something like the police as well, because they've got to account for every penny, and they can't afford to take risks that might go wrong because of that. Everyone's watching them, and there's all these little quangos, all these little organisations, like, you know, people. I mentioned the Taxpayers Alliance. I don't know who they are. I don't know what they do. Their sole job seems to be to moan about how the police are spending their money.
Yeah.
And actually, they're
an organisation that seems to benefit from the requirement of the BBC to give. And on the other hand.
Yeah.
So because there's a need to do on the other hand, like these two people, wherever they're based, are given a voice. But like to your dog show, you think, had the dog show ended up with a pit bull attacking an Alsatian and the...
That would have made the national news.
National news.
Whereas the fact
and
that
people would have said, why are the police wasting money on this?
Completely. Absolutely. There was always that risk element to some of the more left field stuff that we did, but the left field stuff was invariably because we had tried everything that was, you know, short of actually sort of tattooing a barcode onto every person and having their DNA on file and watching every single individual. You know, the only way we were going to solve this is by trying something no one ever tried before. And we had the advantage that we did have a very far thinking boss in Tim Godwin who was willing to give us a little bit of leeway. I mean, I would say we had no budget, we had no resources. Although we say we were based at Scotland Yard, we were on paper, but we moved around. We got shoved from pillar to post. Well, we were in Soho Square at one point. We were down in South London at one point. We were in Earl's Court. We were also in what is now Scotland Yard on the embankment. We got shoved around whenever anyone wanted a big office. You know, they sort of shoved us out and we got put somewhere else. But it didn't matter that much because we were mostly out on the ground all the time. We were mostly out at borough level working, but yeah, it's we had no resources to play with, which in some ways is good. I mean,
yeah, sometimes it's an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, people say sometimes, you know, that necessity is the mother of invention, and it is to some extent. But I'll tell you, the phrase that always gets me is when people say, "Oh, thinking outside the box." See, I've never liked that phrase because, yeah, you can be as adventurous as you like, you can think of anything outside the box, but life doesn't work like that. Life has always got boxes. And we always found that if you put the boxes around You know, if you had to think inside the box, which was, this is how much money we've got to spend, these are the resources in terms of people we've got, you had to be more inventive with what you had. And I found that thinking inside the box was more creative most of the time, because you had to do something out of necessity. You know, you didn't, there wasn't an endless flow of cash you could pull out. It's all very well saying thinking outside the box. If you've got, you know, a multimillionaire around the corner who's going to say, yeah, I'll fund all of that. Never happened. Yeah. Never happened. We probably had nothing.
Final question for you. I was chatting to a fireman. This is more about the day-to-day culture in the police.
Yeah, yeah.
Chatting to a fireman, he said the difference between the fireman and the police, and it's probably through, it's something that's been reached through need rather than anything else. But he said the difference between the fireman and the police is that you're on blue watch or red watch, and often you can serve your whole 30 years with the same 12 people. And so the camaraderie, the humour, the in-jokes build.
And you spend more time with them than you do with your own family.
That's right. He said you laugh so much every day in like the moments of the deepest trauma. He said the difference is with the police, you're never with the same people every day.
That's true.
And so you don't build. Now, that's probably to avoid the dangers of camaraderie. But he said you don't build the same camaraderie in the police as you'd
build
with fire service.
You really don't. I mean, you do work. You know, you get posted to a station, you get posted to a particular shift, which is the equivalent of a watch, you know, and you'll work with those same people for the period of time that you're working at that station. And you choose to remain, you know, a street cop, and you will work with those same people. But some of those people will want to go into CID and they'll disappear, and a new person will come in, and someone else will want to become a dog handler and they'll go off and do that, and someone else will want to go off and be mounted branch or join special branch or do that. You know, the makeup of the shift will constantly change. So even though you stay on the same watch, the same shift, the personnel is in constant change. And then, of course, as with many forces, the Met had a policy that when you'd been somewhere for a certain length of time, it was time to move on. Which I always found a very strange policy, because I would just get to know an area intimately, you know, and all the bad guys and all the relationships between the bad guys and all the streets and everything, and then they'd move me somewhere else and I'd have to start from scratch. But there was such a fear of corruption in the fact that if you do have that deep sense of camaraderie like fire officers get. I mean, I often wonder if a fire officer then did something wrong, how likely would one of the other fire officers on that team be willing to dob them in, you know, to work against them? Whereas it's a bit easier with cops, because you don't form those strong bonds. And I've seen many, many occasions where a cop's done something wrong and the other cops have been the first people to come forward about it. People don't realise that the one thing most cops hate is a bent cop, because it reflects on all of us. So, that there are advantages to it. There's disadvantages too, because like I said, if something... Saying that, fire officers don't necessarily have the opportunities cops do to bad things.
Yeah, you know, I wonder,
that's
though,
the one thing.
So the fire officer said to me is that he said the benefit of that is that the power of humour when it comes to dealing with trauma is immensely powerful.
So like, humour is essential.
So people who've gone through these things, and he said the level of humour that you get from being in this close-knit family, this team, is immensely powerful. Police must have a lot of trauma as well.
They do.
But probably don't have the same sort of support network?
No. I mean, you've got the support of colleagues to a degree. And nowadays, they're much more set up for it, because they do now have sort of counsellors training. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. One job that every cop used to hate was the death message. We had to go and knock on a door and tell someone that one of their loved ones had been killed, generally completely unexpectedly. It's a horrible job, and there's no easy way to do it. You can't stand there and faff, because immediately you're there, people think, oh my God, what's happened? You've got to kind of, not in a brutal way.
Did they train you for that?
No, when I used to do it, but they didn't give you any training for that. Now, as it happens, I was okay doing it. Whether it's a kind of detachment I've naturally got, I used to be able to stand on the doorstep and say, hello, my name's Peter Colgan, I'm from such and such, I'm afraid I've got some bad news for you regarding your son, such and such. And they'll go, oh my God, what's happened? I said, there's no easy way to break this to you. I'm sorry, but he was involved in a motorcycle accident and he's died. And then you bring them down from there. You go in, you make a cup of tea with them, you ask if there's a relative that can come and see them, you offer to give them a lift to somewhere if they've got to go and meet people. There's no easy way to do it, but I've got a degree of detachment. I could do that without getting emotionally involved. A lot of my colleagues couldn't do that. They would find it very emotionally taxing or upsetting. These days, they're much more set up for it. They now have training for this, and there are specific officers whose job is to do this.
Imagine that's your job.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how people do it. Well, I could probably do it, because I'm that sort of person, but, you know, not everyone can do it. It's a horrible job. So But certainly for many, many years, it really was a case of, you know, there was that very macho thing, even to some degree amongst the women, man up, you know, and you know, what sort of weed are you? You can't do that. There was very much that kind of macho atmosphere. That's changed a lot, and it's changed for the better. It really has changed for the better, and people are a bit more prepared for that sort of thing now.
What's the humour like in the police?
It's great. I have to say,
is it? Okay.
It used to be much better because
often see two bubbies walking alongside.
Yeah,
it's miserable.
I know.
They look really awkward with each other.
It used to be a lot more. I mean, a lot of the humour that used to exist, and it was a sort of, I suppose it was a pressure release as well. A lot of the humour amongst cops was very denigrating. There was lots of giving each other nicknames, and there was a lot of doing wind-ups on each other, playing practical jokes on each other and things like that. And a lot of that got cut out because it was deemed to be bullying. I mean, cops used to be brilliant. Cops used to be brilliant at coming up with nicknames for each other. I mean, I mentioned some of them in the book because they were just so inventive. I remember there was one guy everyone called Treasure, and I wondered why. And he said he's got a sunken chest, which I thought was brilliant. or you get, you know, sort of the SO man who, you know, is every Saturday, Sunday off, or you know, the Olympic torch because he never goes out. And there was all these sort of, there was sort of the obvious and the classic ones, but there were also some brilliant ones. But there's other things like when a new probationer came onto your team, you know, there's a brand new probationary officer, sort of 18 years old, fresh, keen, ready to go. There was invariably a practical joke that was pulled on them almost like a rite of passage, but it was never, you know, it wasn't sort of, you know, having a bend over and being bitten with a cracker bat, you know, and sort of please sir may I have another and all that. So it was never nasty. It was always done with a degree of humour where you'd call them to a premises and they'd get water bombed, or in my case, you know, getting a call to the local mortuary to let the ambulance crew in with a body and then actually, you know, someone hiding in one of the fridges, so when I open the door getting it ready for the body to come in, this someone to say shut the door, it's cold in here, and things like this, and it'd make you jump out of your skin. But it was always done with you know, a complete sense of humor, right. and if you got through it and out the other side and you said, oh, you got me there, you were in the gang. It showed that, you know, you'd taken the hit, you were part of the gang, you were willing to have a laugh with them, and you knew then that they would have your back,
right,
no matter what. It was a kind of right. I said that's all considered to be bullying now. Nicknames are considered to be bullying.
Not allowed to use nicknames.
No, I'm sure they still do to some degree, but it's probably really mild names, like calling someone who's called Hodgie or something like that, because you're imposing the name on someone. It's not their choice to have that name, and they don't like that. But and I think the other thing is they're just so overworked. Now there's no time just to sort of kick back, because at least I knew that there were some days when I was posted foot patrol that I could put on my funny hat and I could head off up the street and go for a walk. And chances are I could spend the entire 8 hours wandering around and I wouldn't have much to deal with apart from talking to the community. You know, that's all gone. That's all gone. They are running from pillar to post all the time, trying to keep on top of things. They're under constant pressure from the press, the tabloids, all these different organisations that are scrutinising them. So they've got to live with that now as well. And of course, the other thing is that everything is under scrutiny now. Everyone's got cameras on their phones. Everyone's got cameras on the rooftops. Although saying that, it's not that cops are worried about being caught out. They're not. I love the fact that when vest cams came in, the number of complaints against police dropped substantially.
I was a juror about a month and a half ago, and vest cams transform the perception of a person at a crime scene, because, you know, whereas previously you might have spoken in sort of a moody tone to a police officer, now it looks terrible when that's presented to a court.
Yeah, of course it does. People didn't realise this. Cops were always having to defend themselves. And of course it's he said, she said all the time. And when they said, oh, that we should have these cameras so we can see what police really get up to, cops went, brilliant, now you can see what we have to deal with.
Absolutely.
And I said the number of complaints against police has dropped substantially since they came in, because people can now actually see what really happened. There's a lot more scrutiny, and I think the opportunity for humour is a lot. It's gone a lot, and the opportunity for thinking time has gone as well.
It's a shame, isn't it? When those cuts are made, it seems like people are sort of saying, oh, well, there's no impact on the bottom line. And what you miss is all the stuff that's not on the bottom line.
Yeah, well, the other thing is that whenever there's, you know, it's like London was told to lose 5,000 cops, they'll never take 5,000 cops off the street because that's noticeable. And because they don't want the public to think, oh my God, we're horribly under-resourced now. What will happen is the background boys and girls, all the people who are doing all the prevention work that's keeping the lid on all the crimes from happening, they're the ones who get turfed out of their offices, which means then more crimes happen, which means that those who are on the street now have much more to deal with and are off the street more because they've got arrests and things in. So the number of cops on the street does go down. It's always the people in those backroom jobs who go first. And they're the people who, don't be on the frontline coppering is the hardest job there is. And I've got nothing but respect for people who do frontline work. They're the backbone of the job. But to help them to be able to do their job effectively and to give them the time and the resources to do their job, you've got to have the background people as well, like the traffic division who can handle all the accidents, like the people who are doing all the preventative work, like the people who are doing all the intelligence gathering and sort of building crime maps and working out predictions and patterns. You need all of that to keep a lid on the number of crimes happening. And that's the first thing to go. All the background stuff goes.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Thanks for listening again. So that was our second episode about the police. Back to normal service on the next episode. If you want to hear more, sign up on our newsletter, eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. And I will say to you that my own book, The Joy of Work, is out a month from now. It's out in January 2019. If you are interested in coming to some of the events that I'm doing for that, you can either follow me on Twitter, at Bruce Daisley, or search for Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, and I will put it out as well to the newsletter. So there's about three or four events that I'm speaking at, evening events in the main, and if you're interested in getting involved and coming along to those, you'll find the details there. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.